Yes, that haunting melody welcomes you to another edition of Blind Line at ACB Radio. I'm Jonathan Mosen. It's Saturday, March the 25th today, so we're just about at the end of the first quarter of the last year of the current millennium. Yep, the real new millennium is getting closer. We'll look forward to it. I just like to remind people about that from time to time. Hope you've had a good week. It's been a busy week here at ACB Radio as we prepare the new format. We don't have an exact on-air date yet, but as soon as we can commit to one, we'll announce it. It'll be sometime in April, though. And as you've been hearing over the last week and a bit, we are splitting ACB Radio into three radio stations. It's been fantastic to see the excellent blindness-related music that's been coming in from blind musicians all around the world. We really do want to hear your stuff. You don't have to have released it commercially. If you do this for a hobby and you have a good recording of yourself and you can get it to us in MP3 or Windows Media or Real Media, then please get in touch with us. In fact, I'll give you some details. What we'd like you to do is obviously accompany any tracks with a text file telling us a bit about yourself and about the tracks that you are that you're giving us, and you can send those by FTP to ftp.outofsight, which is all joined together, .org.nz. That's ftp.outofsight.org.nz. Put them in the incoming directory. Now, once you've uploaded those files, you won't see them there, but I will, and I'll be able to get them and include them on the ACB Radio Music channel. Of course, the other one is an old-time radio channel, and we have a lot of new programming coming on our third ACB Radio channel, which we'll be telling you about in the next couple of weeks, including a very exciting new technology show, which is going to be full of cool hints and tips and keeping you up to date with what's happening in the field of blindness technology. So keep your Sunday nights free, because that's when you'll be able to hear this new blindness technology show when the new ACB radio format comes online. Well, enough from me, because we now have something that many people have requested me to do, and this is an interview with the Snowman. Many of you listen to the Snowman radio broadcast and look forward to it each week as I do. The crazy mind, or as he would put it, the wild and demented mind behind this, is the Snowman, Jim Snowbarger. And I had a really great chat to him a couple of days ago, and here is that chat. I began by asking him if he's always been without sight.
Actually, I think I had some sight, according to rumor, and I don't recall it, but glaucoma developed at a fairly early age, and by the time I was between 2 and 3, it was all gone. And I have vague recollection of seeing, but not enough that I can relate to color. I mean, I was at a point where I didn't have labels to stick on things, so I didn't know what they were, and so it was just kind of, it didn't make sense. And now, well, since that time, I've been totally blind, been functioning non-visually all along. So,
where did you grow up?
In Iowa, in central United States. Yeah, out in rural country. Actually, we were on a farm, and living in probably the more economically backward part of the state, and then went to the school for the blind in kindergarten, you know, five years old, where I found out that there were people of all kinds, more variety than I thought there were.
You mentioned in one of your broadcasts about the radio, and obviously it had an impact on you from a very early age. I remember you telling that wonderful story about you turning on the radio in the middle of the night and making one heck of a noise. So you've always been influenced by what's going on the radio, I guess, as many blind people have.
Yeah, it's our medium, really. You know, it's a medium in which you are not left out in any way. It's all right there. Plus, it seemed magical to me. As many people have said, these voices coming through the night, and you just wonder, how do they do that? It was amazing, and nobody I knew could explain how they did it. Well, that right there tripped my trigger. I had to know, you know. So I spent a lot of time thinking about it, and I admired the people that talked on the radio, and I just liked the way they did that, and I wanted to do that myself. So it's always been a passion.
So it was it the technique of radio broadcasting that interested you, or the actual technicality of the transmission, the broadcasting process, or both?
Yeah, it was both. And, you know, I think I told a story one time on my broadcast about how I wanted to broadcast on the radio and spend a lot of time figuring out how to do it. And so that the technology was of interest, and in fact, electronics was a hobby of mine all through childhood, and what led me to electrical engineering, I guess, as a major in college. But I've also been sound-oriented all along, as many blind folks are, and probably for obvious reasons. And I liked the way they talked and the way they timed the music, you know, and I just thought that was entirely too cool. And so when I got my own radio station going at home with by cobbling together various pieces of junk, that's what I tried to do, is emulate the things I heard on the radio. And it just would be altogether too hilarious to hear tapes of that now, because I thought I was so good, but I'm sure I wasn't.
Yeah, I think a number of us have had that experience. What sort of era are we talking about with this?
Oh, this would be the 1960s.
Right, so that was when radio was really moving.
It was hot.
Yeah.
Top 40 was really big. And we lived in an area where you couldn't get access to local rock and roll. You had to go to WLS in Chicago, or there was a 10 kilowatt station in Des Moines, the capital of Iowa, which is probably about 100 miles away. So we were going out of town and actually taking advantage of what AM radio could do for us to get that rock and roll. So that made you more familiar with what else was out there, rather than just having the local station staring you right in the ear, and then you didn't have to look any further.
Yes,
so, at night we would pull in Little Rock and New York even, and you could have your choice. If you're looking for a particular song, you'd dance around between these various stations and look to see who's playing what now. You had three or four opportunities for your favorite song to come up.
Good old WLS, Channel 89, seemed to spare no expense in getting all those wonderful new PAMS jingles. They were always right up there with those.
Yeah, they were the best.
Yeah.
And, of course, all of us who were interested in broadcasting admired those people. They were like gods. They were just, they walked on water. Larry Lou Jack and, oh gosh, of course, Jeffrey Hendricks comes to mind, since his namesake turns up on my show. But a lot of those guys were the idols. Somebody that you tried to talk like and couldn't even come close. But, you know, we developed the, and I certainly developed the diction and paid a lot of attention to how they said words. And I learned at some point that the key to a continuous flow of conversation is to slow down and say words more deliberately. And that gives your mind time to think of what's next, instead of rushing through and then coming up to another hiatus in which you wait and panic and try to figure out what's next.
When you were running your radio station at home, were you actually transmitting, or was it kind of an in-house thing?
No, I was. I was transmitting. Actually, I used the local oscillator inside a radio receiver as my first transmitter, because, you know, they all had that.
Yeah.
And we made good use of that. I'd stick that onto an antenna and learned how to modulate it in, third grade was my first success, quite by accident. It wasn't until many years later that I figured out what I had actually done. But we used the local oscillator radio receiver as a transmitter for probably 6 or 7 years, including the station I put on at the School for the Blind, which was based on that. And then in early high school, I figured out how to make a real AM transmitter and got on and had a crystal-controlled carrier so I could stay on frequency. And there I was putting out an illegal, about a watt and a half, and getting out a couple miles, definitely breaking the law. And I'm terribly sorry about it.
I can tell. I can feel the warmth of your sincerity already. And this was at the School for the Blind that you did the one water.
That was at home. My parents wouldn't let me take it to school, and I don't think our administration would have allowed me to have it either. They really wanted to keep us constrained. And when I would make a technological advance at School for the Blind, somebody would hear it in the community and contact the administration, and they'd shut us down. They were not very supportive, unlike some administrations.
Or was the School for the Blind under the Iowa Commission?
No. It was separate, and actually kind of a... There was some adversity between them.
I see.
Yeah, they didn't get along too well.
Okay.
Actually, I think they sort of grew out of the main political split that we still have today.
Right. So you're saying that the school was more ACB aligned?
Yeah, definitely.
And so how did that affect you as somebody growing up and perhaps starting to take an interest in the politics of the blind community?
I really didn't care. I didn't give a wet slap about much, but playing and having a good time.
That sounds very healthy. You want to do the radio, man.
Yeah,
leave me alone, I'll do the radio. Your parents were supportive of all that you were doing in terms of mastering this technology?
Oh, man, my parents were fantastic. They really just cut me loose and didn't try to hold me back in any way. And that really helped me a lot just in adjusting to life as a blind person in general. You know, they just threw me in and said, go for it, buddy. You know, we're not always going to be around. And so I'm down in the basement tearing radios apart and getting shocked and blowing things up and shorting things out and making mistakes and having some successes here and there. And they just left me alone. You know, if I had a particular question that sight could come in as a handy resource, well, they'd help. My dad helped me build some things because he was better at construction, and I was horrible at it, but I kept trying anyway. And he kept encouraging me to try and giving me pointers along the way, but helping if I really wanted to construct something that would actually last. So we had a pretty good team where I was the engineer and he was the technician, which turned out to be kind of the model for my professional career as well.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
No, my brothers were... I have three half-brothers, but they were much older, so I was by myself.
Right.
Which I had all the time to... And I had all the time that I wanted to hang out in the basement, and I could think of nothing I'd rather do while all the other kids were out playing ball and screwing around. And I did some of that, too. I, you know, rode bicycles and did a lot of that sort of activity stuff, building tree houses and normal kid things. But what I really, really grooved on was doing the radio thing. And I'd hang out in the basement and either experiment or build something or be on the radio playing records. And I couldn't find other kids who wanted to do that. And occasionally my parents would get me together with other kids, and they just didn't seem to really care all that much. It's sort of a neat novelty, but okay, we've done this for a half an hour now, aren't we done? Let's go do something else.
Yes, yes, I can certainly remember kids saying to me, I don't want to play radios anymore.
Yeah, it wasn't that interesting to them.
I mean, how can they do that?
Don't they understand they're real important things in life?
No, it's quite sad the way society is going downhill like that. You went to college and did electrical engineering, and I'm just wondering whether there was any resistance from anybody. Didn't you have a rehab counselor tell you that blind people don't do that sort of thing?
Well, no, actually, the Commission for the Blind was a very progressive and positive organization, and they encouraged me all the way. That was in the heyday, the best days of the Iowa Commission for the Blind. And it might have been instructors in school that said, well, come on, let's be realistic, but the counselors were fantastic. And I was not the trailblazer. A couple of other people had done it before me, so there was a record that it was possible. My trailblazing, I think, was leaving the School for the Blind at the end of 10th grade and going to public school. And even the administration at the School for the Blind said to my parents, don't be surprised if this doesn't work out, because it often doesn't. And, man, when I heard that, I was PO'd. This is going to work out. I will make this work out. And it was a tad of a challenge because it was a major culture shock. But I guess I'm bright enough to figure out how to do the schoolwork, and having gotten good grades, I guess went a long way to convincing people that I could handle this.
How do you feel about blindness education these days? Because most of it is done in the mainstream, and there's a lot of concern expressed about the resourcing that isn't available to blind kids to get the job done. That mainstreaming in and of itself may be okay, but it's not being resourced appropriately. Do you think that's correct?
Oh, you know, there's a double-edged sword there. There are a lot of advantages to staying in the community and staying with your family. And, you know, it's horrible being ripped out of your home at that early age, put in an institution. It was just unbelievable. And I had a kind of a traumatic reaction to that. It's probably warped me for life, to be honest with you. But I know a kid pretty well here locally who's mainstreamed, and he hasn't experienced any of that, but what he didn't get that we did is that he's always been the odd man out. He's always been the alien, the unusual one, and he's learned to think of himself that way. And everybody gave him that message, and he just kind of believes it. And you know, he's in the activities, but he stays on the sideline, and everyone's happy because he's active, but he's not really doing anything. Well, at the School for the Blind, we all of our peers were just like us, and we thought we were normal until everybody kept telling us that we weren't. We really thought we were. And that inspired us to reach out and grab our world and do more things to it. I think it developed a fundamental concept of ourselves as being okay. And that you really need that, you know, because you get a lot of assault from the people who don't understand blindness, tearing away at your self-concept. And if you don't have a pretty good fundamental grasp, it's easy to slip down. So I think that's a major factor is that. And then as far as the resources are concerned, what I see here is, yeah, it's fairly minimal. Even a lot of the teachers and some of the special teachers that work with this guy don't really know what's possible, so they don't know how to challenge him appropriately. And in the case of at the School for the Blind, those teachers knew what blind, they knew blind people well, and a lot of them were blind, and so they knew what was possible. And they wouldn't take any crap if you whined because you couldn't do something, and they knew it was possible. They'd just make you do it. You know, so we got a lot more challenges than these kids do. I think that's a problem.
It's the kind of he's doing okay considering mentality, isn't it?
Exactly. And yet he isn't really. He's missing out on those opportunities to excel. I'm convinced that that life itself flourishes best when adversity and opportunity are combined. And he has adversity, but not a lot of opportunity. And he actually, in a lot of ways, people are trying to make life easy for him, which reduces the adversity. The adversity makes you rise to the occasion, and it challenges you to dig in and get stronger. And when people don't have high expectations of you, they just strive to make life comfortable, and they don't challenge you because they don't want to make you uncomfortable. So it's there's some opportunity being missed.
Is it a question of blind adults being used more as role models, peer support mechanisms being better organized? What's the answer there?
I don't know what the answer is. I think it's a difficult question, really, because there aren't enough of those. And in some cases, you're lucky enough to have one nearby, but very often, because there are so few of us, you won't. So I don't really know what the answer is. I'm unsure. You know, I think there were minuses for us, too, being gathered together in that that School for the Blind, which is kind of a subculture, and they talked to us at length about how we would get an awakening when we went out there and found out what it was really like. And I went out there, and I did get an awakening. I found out that I didn't realize there were so many low-grade people in the world until I went out there. They were telling us they were all pretty smart, high-grade people. But the key point is it was a subculture, and so leaving that subculture was a shock. That's the main disadvantage, I think, of the institutional approach. So you don't, you can have a hard time integrating.
Did you find any co-conspirators at the public school with regard to broadcasting?
Yeah, I did find one. There was a guy who, out of about 2,000 kids, there was one who worked at the local radio station, and I called him up when he was on the air, and we just sort of struck up a conversation, and that turned out to be a pretty good relationship. I tried to get a job at that station, but that guy told me it was impossible, and he wouldn't hire me. And he has he since has moved to another community, and it turns out to be the one I live in now. I know him. I've done commercials on his station, quite a few, actually, quite a bit of production for him. So it's sort of funny that he wouldn't hire me, and yet I'm, and now I'm providing material to him. But there are, there really were some logistical problems. There still are, really, logistical problems to deal with in broadcasting. Reading material. You know, there's a lot of stuff. Most of the people who are on the radio are reading. And it's all in print, and you got to find a way to translate that to something you can deal with. And it takes sometimes some extra effort. Technology helps there.
Yeah.
But in the day I was in radio, we didn't really have it.
No, gosh, I remember having to use one of those old sharp talking clocks, which you would turn the stopwatch on at the top of the hour so that you could have exact split-second time checks to time things out to the news and things like that, you know. These days you just use a braille light or something.
Oh, absolutely. See those seconds tick down the braille display? Piece of cake now.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, braille, while it's excellent, and I'm a supporter of braille, I think it's a wonderful thing and should not be allowed to slide, it's, you have a bandwidth limitation compared to print. I don't see any way around it.
What do you mean by that?
You can't read as fast. You can't scan as fast. You have more space to cover. And I don't know anybody who does read as fast as a good fast print reader who can glance around and see things and pull something out of a pile, you know, see a fraction of something in a pile sticking out under the edge there and know exactly what they want, pull it out and start reading it immediately. They can do that very quickly. And I think it's harder to do that. You need to be a little more organized if you're going to be a blind broadcaster. There are a couple of people who come to mind who read surprisingly fast. But your average braille reader does good to stay up at conversational speed.
Do you consider yourself a proficient braille user?
Not quite, almost. I'm not too bad, but I'm not as good as I'd like to be. Mm. And I never was. You know, even in grade school and junior high when we'd have to read out loud in class, I was terribly uncomfortable with that. And there were some people who were, there were two girls who were really good in our class, and the rest of us were just pretty bad. And, you know, I can read at conversational speed, but I kind of like to pre-read it before I do that, so I sort of know what the deal is. When I do commercials, for example, often I have to talk really fast, and I can't read that fast. So I'll end up basically memorizing part of the commercial and doing it in pieces. And I read it as I do that to remind me, but I wouldn't be able to just cold read it that fast.
Yeah. Did you manage to do any radio stuff while you were busy doing the books there?
Oh, yeah. I was in student radio. I was active in that. I was the, what was my title? Production director, I guess. And I loved that. That was fantastic. We had a little 10-watt FM station there at the campus. It developed my skill again, and I've got a few recordings of that. Again, I was not as good as I thought I was, but improving.
No, but that's interesting that you say that, because I think if somebody is really particular about what they do when it's something like radio, there aren't many things that you can listen to that you actually like. Wouldn't that be true? I mean, when you listen to something in retrospect, you think, God, I could have done that better.
Yep. Yep, absolutely. That self-criticism is what makes you better. You know, I'm a weird combination of arrogance and ego on the one hand and devastating self-doubt on the other. And the current that flows between those two opposite poles in my life is probably the energy that makes me tick.
I think probably most broadcasters are like that. It's just that they don't choose to articulate it, or they don't have a sense of self-knowledge that allows them to realize that. I think it's that combination that makes a good broadcaster.
Yeah, that's probably true. So, and you'll get better if you have the nerve to admit that you didn't do very well there, and to listen to yourself and revel in how good it sounds is great fun, but to admit that it really wasn't very good isn't fun, but it has to be experienced. to encourage you to improve, to kind of develop that sensitivity within you. And I guess I've come to figure that realistically, since virtually everything I've done in life I later listened to and thought it wasn't that great, I'm probably not very good today either. But I'm having a great time not being very good, and hopefully getting better all the while.
So were you hoping for a full-time career in broadcasting? Is that what your ambition was?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. My father talked me out of it because he probably realistically decided it wasn't likely to be as lucrative as the engineering career, and I'd say in the main that's true, although there are certainly exceptions. And I was entertained the fantasy that I could have been an exception. And I almost switched from engineering to broadcasting. It was right after my first calculus final exam, I think. But he talked me out of it. Then when I got out of college, of course, I ran into the challenge of getting a job as a blind person, which, you know, that was fairly difficult then, and still is, I suppose. And in the meantime, waiting for a job, I got a job at my local radio station and did kind of the midday FM thing where I was playing Andy Williams and some of that and trying to stay awake. And I just didn't enjoy it at all. You know, it wasn't what I had in mind. And so when I got an opportunity to do some work for the Commission for the Blind at probably twice the money, and the fact that my girlfriend at the time lived in Des Moines, where the commission was probably a factor in that decision. So I jumped out of radio and went off to do something else. And then a couple of years of that, and then I got a job in engineering. So
what were you doing at the commission?
I did. I traveled around the state working with newly blinded adults in their homes. Just to, well, they have various terms for this, and they change them all the time. But basically to convince people that they could still live at home and they could still do a lot of the things around the house that they used to do. You know, teach them how to label their washer and dryer and how to cook still and do the laundry and, you know, just basic living techniques. And I don't know if I changed anybody's lives, but I think a lot of people enjoy talking to me. It's about all I can say.
And this would still have been the Iowa Commission of Kenneth Jernigan at this time.
Yeah, I worked for him.
Yeah, and what are your memories of him?
He was phenomenal, a frightening person, actually. I found him disconcerting, but one of the brightest people I've ever met, and probably the most effective boss I've ever had. He made an organization sing. Boy, he fine-tuned it, and he had purpose in everything he did. And I really have a lot of respect for that even now. But I wasn't comfortable, not at all. Of course, to be honest with you, I think at the time my objectives were not so much in doing excellent work, but in having a good time, and his values were the opposite. So there was a little bit of a conflict there. He didn't have as much respect for me as I thought he should for that reason, because you know, I was not applying discipline to my life like he would have liked me to do, and encouraged everybody else to do, and I think he did. And now that I've grown up a tad, I see the value in that discipline, and you know, finding a happy medium, perhaps. But discipline and excellence have come to mean a lot more to me in later life, especially as I've seen the culture decline. Where a lot of things that are not done particularly well, and I'm really just tired of that. I'd like to see people really committing themselves to doing whatever it is that they do as well as it can possibly be done. And he encouraged people to do that. And especially for blind people, and he realized that it was important. And for blind people, we can't afford to be average, basically. You know, when you go to try to convince an employer to hire you, there are some obvious disadvantages that strike him right off the bat. I'm going to have to deal with adaptive equipment issues, and there are going to be some things that I can't have this person do that I can have another, a sighted person will be just more flexible to me, basically. So since I've got these constraints in hiring you, what advantages are there that will outweigh them? And I think being really excellent at what you do and having discipline and having a commitment to quality is part of that, and part of what you can sell, you know, what you can use to sell yourself. I think Jernigan was right on top of that.
Did you get involved in the Federation?
Yeah, I was in it in the 70s, and to the point of, local and state officer, but I'm not really a joiner. I never have been, and I was not really comfortable in the, there's an insider psychology that I just really didn't belong to, and probably never will, I guess. So I've been around both organizations a tad. When the NFB split up in Iowa at one point, and the ACB affiliate was born there, well, actually reborn, it was the second incarnation of it, I was around the ACB affiliate for a while, and then I kind of drifted away from that too. So now I kind of look at both organizations from a distance, and I likened them to the Republicans and the Democrats, and guess for yourself which is which. If you need to,
I think I can. I don't know whether it would be the same as what you would guess, but
I bet it would. I would say that the ACB is the Democrats. Now that doesn't necessarily. Now I like a lot of ACB. Actually, a lot of my best friends are ACB people.
Oh, so you're saying that the calling ACB Democrats is potentially not a nice term. You're a conservative.
I am. I'm basically conservative. And I
ditto head.
I would say I am, although I'm not a. That doesn't mean I am a carbon copy of Rush Limbaugh. I choose for myself, and I'm actually pretty liberal about certain things. I'm quite conservative about some other things. I'm not what you'd call a middle of the roader. I'm an extremist on both ends, and that's what's odd, is how you can have these extreme views on either end that would seem to be conflicts.
What do you think of Rush as a broadcaster?
I admire him a lot. Absolutely. I'd like to, and I probably am influenced a lot by him, even in what I do, although I try to take politics out of it.
Yes, so actually, when I heard your first Snowman radio broadcast that I listened to, it did strike me that, you had that same ability to just talk off the cuff at length.
BS ad nauseum.
Yes.
You know, that type of, yes. Well, that's it's stream of consciousness talk, I guess, and that's what I do. If I can really get rolling, is I think I talked about this in some broadcast somewhere along the way. I think verbally. I talk to myself all the time. So for me, it's a matter of just opening my mouth and letting those thoughts come out, and the trick is to screen some of them out, so not everything gets said. But and Rush does that too. That's why he repeats himself a lot, and some people listen to him and get kind of tired of it for that reason, because he does say things over and over. I know I do. Say them in different ways. Not always bad, because. Taking the same message and reformatting it six different ways means you might reach different sets of people. You know, people have different mindsets and different language sets that they use, and the same words don't always reach every group. So, yeah, but I guess Rush was the one that really made me want to do this internet radio thing.
Mm.
That's what woke me up and said, I want to do something like that. And my goal was to just turn on the mic and do my thing, whatever that turned out to be that particular day. And that's really how I started out. But I didn't really want to get into my philosophies too heavily or my radical politics or any of that, because I wanted to reach more people. And as the thing has started to grow, I'm starting to get a little more conscious of trying to tailor it to be acceptable to more people. And I'm not quite sure how comfortable I am with that. I was a little more comfortable when I was just free-forming it. And so I'm leaning back that way. I free-form it, but I have sort of acceptance criteria that I apply to, to keep certain things out, to make it a little bit more accessible. But I don't have much of a goal beyond that. I guess there is a secondary goal. I do talk about blindness in the program fairly often, because I think I'm not just talking to a blind audience, and I want to reach people who aren't comfortable with blind people and don't know them, and to have them hear me, like me, admire what I'm doing, think I'm a sharp guy, and then find out I'm blind, I think is a good thing. I want to shock them into saying, wow, they're real people too.
Yes, or even, wow, he doesn't sound blind.
Yeah, and I've had that said before.
Yeah, most people in radio have had it said to them, it's incredible.
Yeah.
America's a really interesting country in terms of extremes, I suppose. I mean, you've got, for example, Howard Stern, where pretty much anything goes, and you've got people who will jam the switchboards if you say the word damn on the radio. So how do you determine what constitutes humor?
I don't know what, that's a tough question, and it's one I wrestle with all the time. I don't know who my audience is, for one thing. And they're forming around me because I'm just doing whatever comes natural, whatever suits my sensibilities, and the people who find that acceptable and entertaining are just going to gravitate to the program. And the audience is forming kind of by default. When I think about what's funny, I'm, for one thing, pressured by the appetite that's been developed by modern humor to be extremely irreverent and kind of bawdy and nasty, and that's a pressure I don't like. I'd like my show to be funny enough that middle and later year Christians can find it funny, and yet young people who may be a tad irreverent and not particularly religious can still find it funny. That's what I shoot for in my own mind, to not be overly offensive and yet be just a tad racy. It's just a delicate line, can't be described, but I can feel it as I go across it. And I'm fine-tuning that sense, just not necessarily based on feedback, because mostly people don't write me and say that was disgusting and I don't want to hear that anymore. I never had that happen.
But I presume you have had a lot of supportive feedback from people?
Yeah, almost entirely.
Yeah.
I presume the people who don't like it just don't. Right, and that's the beauty of it. You know? Leave it in the fact I told him one time to do that. If you don't like this show, don't write me and tell me about it. Just don't listen. You know, I did a commercial one time in which I think I used the... something happened, and this character in the commercial was surprised and said, oh, my God, and then went on to say something else. And some little old lady called the radio station and was offended by that. And the radio station, this is back in the tape editing days, they got the razor blade out and they cut that phrase out and bastardized and butchered this commercial. So it just sounded totally unnatural. Put it on the air, and the client called up and said, what the hell happened to my commercial? I went back the way it was.
Yeah.
So, you win some and you lose the rest, but, geez.
Oh, it is frustrating. The Snowman Radio broadcast started with Livestream America.
Yeah, it did. I owe those guys a great debt of gratitude. They helped me out a lot, and they've been my archive site all along. They're friends of mine, and although I don't know them well, but friends over the net anyway, and they were looking for some programming, and they told me that. And but they didn't ask me to do a show. They just said, "No, we're doing this thing," you know. And I said, "Well, I could probably send you half an hour a week. And they were surprised and said, "Why? Well, we didn't think you'd want to do it. You know, we just didn't think of that." And I just thought this is something I had thought about doing in the back of my mind. And here these guys are doing this website. They need material, and it was time. You know, it was time to do it. That was last summer. We're now 26 broadcasts down the road. And we're on 1, 2, 3 outfits, including yours.
What's the third one?
Give Me Talk.
Oh, of course, yes, you're on Give Me Talk.
Yeah.
You're a man of the world.
Well, I am part of the world, that's true. Yeah. You run into me as you drift around.
Yes. Tell me a little bit about how long it takes to put together and some of the gear that you use to put it together.
It takes most of Saturday from, oh man, it takes too much time. I start thinking about the program probably about Thursday, wondering what am I going to do, and I don't know. By Friday night I have some, well, maybe I can lead off with this, you know, and so I got something to come out of the music and start talking about. But then I figure I'm home free, because once I get rolling, it just kind of falls out from there. And I start Saturday afternoon probably about 2, and I start working, so I have to catch Blind Line out of the archives. That's why I never call.
Because that
Saturday
outrageous.
Is just the right day for me.
I hope you're going to be listening to this one.
Yeah, I have to listen to this one. I have to see what I said. Of course I was. You have to see what you edited out.
You just wait and see what I do with the digital editing, man. I can reconstruct your sentences.
I know how it's done.
Yeah.
I know it can be.
Yeah.
So it'll keep me, I'd say, about 3 hours of recording time to get the show pretty much done. And then I go and I do mixing. And I find things that need to be a little different. Or I need to drop a sound effect in here or a little comment there. And or maybe it's a little long. So I do editing for another couple, 3 hours probably. So that's 5 or 6 hours to generate that half hour program.
Yeah.
And I'm using multi-track tape at the moment, analog tape, have been for quite some time. I have Cakewalk, but haven't learned how to use it, and I'll be drifting that way, and hopefully it will work out well. But analog tape is what I'm really just comfortable with, and I want to stay focused on the program and the content, and I want to be the talent rather than the engineer. So I want things to be as easy as possible. I have an effects device that has 4 separate effects processors in it. They can be either linked together in various ways or run totally independent. And I have about 3 major sound effect settings that I use as I do things, including my a compressor limiter for my standard voice. And those I've got set up in the effects processor, so they're just always sitting there ready for me to feed something through. And Hefty Genitals is one of them, you know, shifted down in pitch. And,
that is really very good. And you've obviously got a whole studio. Is it at home dedicated to all this
yep.
stuff?
Yep, yeah. It's a spare bedroom in the upper floor of my house. It's I got a rack of effects devices, several keyboards because I do music as well, the tape machines, CD, DAT, you know, that kind of thing, and a little 8-channel mixing board. So it's a fairly standard, not terribly fancy studio. It's a matter of knowing how to make use of it, and that's always been my knack. You know, even
yeah.
when I was a kid, I was taking junk and make it. Do something useful.
Oh, so. The top rating broadcaster in New Zealand, like he gets, you know, paid well into the 7 figures, once said to me something that I've never forgotten when I was running a radio station with sort of very ancient gear, and he said to me, "The best radio has come out of boxes."
Yep, it ain't what you got, it's what you do with it, has been said in many different contexts.
I think Dr. Ruth has said that once.
Probably, yes.
Yeah.
And it would be true.
I'm sure that's where I've heard that before.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you are, though, moving gradually into the digital age. You know,
I do editing in the digital domain. When I mix the thing off of analog tape into SoundForge or FastEdit is the one I use. And although you sound forge some too, just a matter of what you're comfortable with. And and then I'm in digital from there on, and I'll do, you know, cutting and pasting and mixing type things.
What do you think of it? I mean, do you think that digital editing is as flexible a medium as playing around with a good old piece of tape?
Well, generally, it's more so. There are a couple of things that you like. For example, a pitch shift. If you want to shift the pitch, but you want to vary the amount of shifting, sort of like you would do if, let's say, you started dragging your hand on the side of the reel to slow it down, back up.
Yep.
So it doesn't, the amount of shift is not constant. It's variable. That's harder to do with any package that I know about.
Yeah.
But in the main, I think digital is the way to go because, man, you can get atomic accuracy. You can do it exactly the way you want. And I can edit things so you can't tell they were edited pretty easily. I'm sure you can, too. There's actually a knack to digital editing. And I've noticed that a lot of it is done badly. You hear it on the radio where they take the pauses out, they chop things down to where it doesn't sound natural,
yeah.
Chop breaths off or whatever.
Yeah, it's so frustrating. You know, people, it upsets the natural speech sound.
Yeah, it does. The rhythm of speech, you bet.
Yeah. But that's because one thing I've found in my days in broadcasting is that most people who play with this gear don't actually listen. They're looking at meters in the picture of the wave on the screen or whatever, but they don't actually listen.
You are absolutely right. That's we ought to be able to sell that idea to those people who make Cool Edit and SoundForge and what have you. That to get your eyes off the screen and get this enamored kind of love affair with graphics over with and get down to what it is you're really trying to do. You can actually edit a sound file without looking at the screen at all. And I would think that those guys would actually want to know how to do it because there's a lot of stress and energy spent in staring at the screen and trying to figure out what you're doing. I've seen people do this that I've worked with. You know, they're preoccupied with it and takes their mind away from the artistry. And just like with writing music, it's nice to be able to get the technology to help you and not become the primary focus.
Yeah, and in the Snowman Radio broadcast, you always manage to get a bit of your own stuff in there. So you've obviously also got a good range of synths and keyboards and stuff like that that you're using.
Yeah, I have two synthesizers and one sampler and a drum machine.
Yeah.
And, of course, a MIDI sequencer, because I'm not really a good keyboard player, I can do what I can do, but my ideas outrun my hands pretty quickly. And then I do the vocal stuff. I do some instrumental things, and I do some vocals, but I haven't written a lot of music lately.
You told me, you told the world on one of your broadcasts you'd sort of gone off vocals. You hadn't found a lot to sing about, that you're doing mainly instrumental stuff.
Yeah, that's right. I wasn't unhappy enough. I was inspired, I think, when I was lonelier in my single days. I was inspired to come up with lyrics, but it's not necessarily true that when people get married and get in major relationships, they get less creative, but I can think of a lot of examples where it did happen, and I think with me it did.
Yeah.
The other thing is that since I've gotten into this snowman thing, I don't have time. Just don't have time and energy to do that. So,
Is Snowman the nickname that you've always had, or is that something you invented for this program?
No, some people have called me that over the years. And it just kind of stuck. I don't know, somebody invented that probably 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And it just kind of stuck with me, and I don't know why I used it. I really don't know why.
I mean, if you'd have gotten to radio full-time as a rock jock or something, you might have had to adopt a name.
Yeah, I would have.
Definitely not Hefty Genitals, though.
Oh, no, I don't think so.
No.
You'd probably get a lot of calls on that. But see, Hefty... As I explained, Hefty Genitals came from Jeffrey Hendricks of WLS, who was somebody that I and several people I knew really admired, and somehow that became we developed this character called Hefty Gendrix, just obviously turning the syllables around, or the first letters around, and it degenerated from there. Well, the way this creative process works, it defies explanation. Things just happen for no apparent reason. I think there's this random source of ideas that I have running in my head, and they just pop out for no apparent reason, totally unbidden. And I react to them, some of them I like. And the ones I like, I keep, maybe I'll do on the show. That's how it works, you know, stuff just pops out.
Yeah.
It is the weirdest thing.
I think that the amazing thing about the program is that you have the ability to hone in on the ridiculous side of an issue or a thing and really accentuate it, or the defining characteristic of anything. For example, with the Hefty Genitals character, who is a newsreader, you've got the nuances of that classic sort of Cronkite style newsreader, absolutely down to a fine art. And with the buddy phone simulation, I got a lot of feedback about that.
We can all relate to that.
You know, basically, you really just picked up on the everybody. Hey, wow, you know, this is internet telephony and it's great. But of course, everybody who uses it really knows that it's full of problems, and you accentuated the problems.
It's great, and we're all hating it.
Yeah.
I find that stuff funny. The ironies of life are terribly amusing to me, and I like to characterize things, over-characterize them, or, you know, stupid little things will amuse me, like somebody who is famous and has gotten 7 cards and letters. I find that funny, that they only got 7, and you'll say it as though they got tons and tons of them. They got 7.
I used to say on the air, you know, a letter has just come pouring in.
Exactly.
You know. Do you play these programs to your wife? Does she listen?
Yeah, she does listen in. We don't necessarily listen to them together. She listens to them when I'm not around, and I think she fantasizes that it's someone else. I don't want to take that from her.
Do you have a family?
We have. We're old enough. Our kids are in college, so have two.
Yeah. Are they into radio at all? Into production?
Oh no, they don't care about any of that.
Oh.
Nah. Well, you know, most kids are more into television and movies and things like that, if they're into anything at all. And then if they're into media at all, none of ours are. And then there's the fact that the old man does it, then who wants to do it? You know, my parents weren't.
Yeah, I guess this is the reality I'm going to have to face.
Yeah, they got their own program to follow, just like you did.
Yeah. You've developed a pretty successful thing on the side, doing a lot of audio production and things, but you're also in the software industry, separate from all of this.
Right. That's actually how I make my living, that's what pays the bills, is writing code. Doing microprocessor, embedded controller work. Not like it would be on a PC, but although I do a little bit of that. Of course, I do quite a bit of JAWS scripting here and there.
Yes, you've written the Winamp scripts that probably a heck of a lot of our listeners are using right now.
David Truong started those. Is that his name? How do you say that?
He pronounces it Truong.
Truong?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, speech synthesizers will do that to you.
It's amazing, you know, when I've rang up people to interview and found out that you pronounce their names totally different from how the speech synthesizers...
Sorry. Well, David started those. He figured out all the help stuff, and I thought that was great. So I took that and enhanced that to do the Winamp playlist editor. And I like JAWS scripting. It's neat how you can really bring programs to life, and sometimes make them operate more conveniently in ways that don't really have anything to do with screen access.
Yeah, well, that's right.
So I do that, and I'd like to do some more of that. I could really, I've thought from time to time that if I lost this job and I didn't go into some sort of entertainment thing, that screen access is something I could work on with a lot of passion, knowing the need for it firsthand. It's pretty frustrating not being able to get at the information that you want quickly, to pull an application out of the box and be excited and find that you can't use it. It's just... Yeah, it can inspire you to violence, that's what I often say.
Well, yes, and I'm sure. So the advent of Windows and things hasn't really affected the work that you do in your current job?
Yeah, it has, because we use PC-based tools
okay.
to do it.
Yeah.
So you bet it has.
And
what we actually write in my day job is embedded controller work, is a microprocessor that might be in a device, like you're in your car or... your VCR, actually they're all over the place.
Yes.
And but we use PC-based tools to do that. And yeah, I had to climb the Windows frame with everybody else. And you know, I kind of like it actually, now that I've gotten used to it. The thing about the days when people started getting fancy with their DOS programs, and very often you'd find that they wouldn't talk at all. You know, they just did some really weird stuff, and they'd capture interrupts, keyboard interrupts, and steal it away from your speech package and all manner of things.
I'm glad to hear you say this, because that's absolutely right. They went into this graphics mode thing, and
yeah.
We did not have access to the DOS graphics mode, and people go on and on about the good old days of DOS. That's rubbish. By the time we were finishing our DOS days, we were getting locked out of more and more stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
And people forget that.
And this fixed that, because it standardized the way people do a lot of those things, and
yeah.
Increasingly people are playing by the rules and tools that are made available to them by Microsoft or by the people who develop their development system, like Visual C++. You know, if you want to put up a button, you use the same technique that everybody who uses Visual C++ will use, because it's just easier to do that than to make your own. So standardization happened not because people thought they should be, just because it saved them time.
Now, you were talking about JAWS scripts, and am I able to say that you are working without any definite release date on some SoundForge scripts?
Yeah, I've got some. I'm not taking a comprehensive approach to that, because I think there'll be more work on that done by other people. That'll save me time, and then I'll probably take theirs and improve it again. But I have an initial set that. It really makes it pretty easy to move through the file. I'd kind of like to finish that up here. I'm really, really close to finishing that up. There are a lot of weird windows in SoundForge that don't speak extremely well, and I'm not really dealing with that aspect of it. There's quite a bit of work there. But what I deal with mostly is I wanted to be able to hold the cursor key down. In fact, in a future program coming up shortly, I'll be demonstrating this. would be show 26, and about 2 weeks from now. And you hold down the cursor key, say the right arrow, and just listen to it skim through the audio, much like it does when you hold down the fast forward on a CD player. So you can find something just by listening.
Well, that's an enhancement that would benefit more than just the blind community, of course.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
That's why I put it in my show, because I even want sighted guys to hear about this. And, you know, maybe they can even start encouraging... the editor developers to make that just a standard part of their package, and then we can all have it. We don't have to do scripts. You can, if you run WindowEyes, you can still do it, you know. Anytime we can sell sighted people on the idea that something is good for their own reasons, and yet it benefits us, it's to our advantage, because
yep.
then it'll happen.
Yep.
You know, they're not going to do things unless they're forced to do them that strictly benefit us. But if we can define it in such a way that it has benefit for everybody, then it's a lot more likely to happen.
So do you have any plans for the future in terms of expanding the kind of internet talk that you're doing?
I'm very much feeling my way. I don't know where I'm going. I have an idea that maybe it could grow into something, and I kind of believe that in my heart, but I don't know exactly what it's going to be. I don't know whether it's going to take the same shape. I think it'll evolve. I would like to take this further. I really would. I think I think it's unique. It's I think I do it better than a lot of people do, and even people that are getting paid to do it. And I'd like to develop that skill and get better than I am at it.
What about a live show? I mean, you're obviously quite quick to be able to take calls and have a bit of interaction with the audience. Could be a bit of fun.
Maybe a riot to try it. I don't know. I don't know whether it would come out as well as it does, because I can back up if I start talking about something that really is stupid, or start stumbling all over myself. I can just erase it, you know. So the show I do now sounds a little better than it is, because I take the bad stuff out. It would be fun, fantastically fun, to try that. I've never had that opportunity, and I think I would rather groove on that. So, but I'm not quite sure how that'll take shape. I don't have good networking capability at the moment. But and then there's the business of how you raise money at this. I would like to do it, but I'd like to, if I really get serious about it, I'd like to earn some cash for my effort. I think it's a good to earn cash, and you know, if I could do that successfully, I could devote more time to it. But right now, I'm just experimenting with it to see if it catches on and if there's really a market for it or not.
Well, you're a pioneer, and the good thing is that under the new ACB radio format, we will have the Snowman radio broadcast on demand, so that people can hear it when they want. They can wake up at 3 a.m. and tune in to you.
That would be a nightmare, wouldn't it?
Well,
but you wouldn't know if you were dreaming or this is reality.
So we're looking forward to offering that, because we're working on the scheduling system, and decided that, well, the best way around that is to actually let the listener do the scheduling.
That's a major improvement. That'll be fantastic. You can tell exactly when things are going to be on and pick the things that you want to hear most. It's the neat thing about the internet radio, I think, is your ability to basically define a narrow cast that's just for you, you know, the stuff that you want to hear.
Yeah.
Thanks for carrying the show, by the way. I very much appreciate it.
It's just, I actually look forward to it, you know. At about the time I know that it's coming, I check the email about 50 times an hour just to make sure. and then I listen to it, and then I send it onto the ACB machine.
I see.
It's
first dibs, huh?
One of the highlights of my week. So, no, I think you're doing a marvelous job. And thank you for coming on the program, because I had people email me, and this is the honest truth, saying, you know, we want to know more about this dude. So I thought I'd get you on the show.
Fantastic. It was a pleasure. I'm glad we did it.